Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
You're listening to The Cricket Collective on TalkSport 2 with me, Neil Manthorpe, and former England fast bowler Steve Harmison. And as always, we've got another busy show in store. We'll take a look back at New Zealand cancelling their tour of Pakistan. We'll get the latest on the Ashes with Australian cricket writer and broadcaster Robert Craddock, and look back at a thrilling T20 finals day, which saw Kent win their first trophy in 14 years. As well as that, we'll pay tribute to the great Michael Holding, who retired from the commentary box this week. You're listening to The Cricket Collective on TalkSport 2. Well, Harmy, it hasn't been announced at the time we're doing the show, but I cannot see England going. Can you?
No, I can't see England going. I think the same security company look after New Zealand, they look after England, and I feel so sorry for the Pakistan fans. How hard was it? Wasim Khan especially. I know the guy personally, he's a top man, and you know, I played against him quite a few times in my early days. And he's tried so hard to get people back to Pakistan, the love for Pakistan cricket again. He's built bridge after bridge, sent teams over to England during COVID. And for this to happen, I'm just talking about Wasim personally. I really feel for that guy because he's tried to, you know, to get the world to come back to Pakistan and play cricket. I've been a few times. It's a fascinating place to go and play. And to not have cricket in your own country, especially for you as a player. I'm thinking of that as a player. You know, to have your family watch you play a home test match or a home one day international or a home T20 is arguably the best thing you'll ever do as an international sportsman. And for that just to be taken away at the last minute like it has been, you know, I'm not going to judge on politics or anything like that. It's somebody else's game. But where we are at this moment in time, I just can't see England going to Pakistan for reasons of security. And that is sad, really.
Now let's hear from Pakistan and their government minister, Asad Umar, who was understandably disappointed.
The decision is perplexing. It doesn't reconcile with what the team, the New Zealand team, had experienced in their 6 days so far in the city.
Pakistan Government Minister Asad Umar. Delighted to say that we're joined now by ESPN Cricket Info's Osman Samiuddin, who will no doubt have been following proceedings in Pakistan with great concern and great care and probably great remorse as well after everything that Pakistan have done, many people, to get international cricket back there. But it was the shock of how it happened, Osman. I think that caught all of us by surprise. I know that you've been following developments. My goodness me, to leave a tour to pull out at such last-minute notice, quite extraordinary. What have you learnt?
Yeah, it is, you know, extraordinary and sad, I guess, for Pakistan. But, you know, from a distance, I think you can understand why it's happened. You know, and it's not in New Zealand's control as to when the threat comes to them. It's come, and they've had to react to it, and they've made the best decision in their own interest, which is completely understandable. I mean, we were told early on that, you know, the threat had emerged, I think, 36 hours before the scheduled pickup of the game, and part of the time it took for just the threat to filter down from governments to cricket boards and so on, and to be shared and stuff. And so I know that NZC got in touch with Pakistan, with the Pakistan Cricket Board at like 3 a.m. Pakistan time, Friday morning. So the game was 12 hours later, and they got in touch with the Pakistan Cricket Board at 3 a.m. So, you know, that gives you an indication of when they would have found out. If that would have been, what, 11, I think, in the morning in New Zealand, and they would have found out probably overnight, which tallies to the whole 36-hour thing. So I think the timing of it was not in their control. And there was, I think there's little doubt that there was some kind of threat there. Of course, there, you know, they wouldn't have come to Pakistan in the first place if they didn't want to play. That's what I keep saying to people who are very angry about this, is that they wouldn't have come to Pakistan for the first time in 18 years if they didn't want to play. And, you know, they only would have gone out, they would have abandoned it only because they clearly felt that there was something credible there that they just couldn't take a chance on.
The fact that David White said that there were details of the threat that he would not share with the Pakistan Cricket Board, either publicly or privately, adds a level of mystique and terror, I suppose, to the threat. I guess we'll never know, or maybe in 30 years' time or 20 years' time. But that level of secrecy concerns me to the point where it will add to the doubts of other nations and future engagements that the PCB attempt to organize.
Yeah, you know, I think that's very much down to the relationships between countries and cricket boards. So, you know, New Zealand and Pakistan have a fine relationship, but it's not like they have a very deep and long-standing relationship in that sense. I think, you know, with a board like the England Cricket Board and the governments of England and Pakistan, there may have been more information sharing. It does seem strange that they didn't want to share the threat, but maybe there was an element of not trusting enough. I wouldn't say distrust, but not trusting enough that information at the risk of the safety of their own players at that time.
The other concern, Oz, is that the perception will be created, no doubt, that this threat was a threat at cricket rather than the New Zealand cricket team. I mean, everyone loves the Kiwis, don't they? I mean, that's like threatening soft toys.
You know what? I'm not 100% sure. And like, I'm no security expert, but if you go by how, you know, they've terror groups have reacted and acted in the past and the kind of threats they've made, I suspect it would be a move. It would be more of a threat to Western nations or, you know, NATO countries. So you were looking at countries like the UK, you're looking at countries like Australia and New Zealand. And I would feel and I think that the attention wouldn't be so high on countries like Sri Lanka touring or Bangladesh touring or even the West Indies. South Africa came earlier in the year and, you know, there were no issues there. And, you know, what we were told, we spoke to some security officials and they said that, you know, these kind of, or the threats that they believed had been made are the kind of threats that happened before any of these big cricket events anyway. And they kind of take it as par for the course now. And their assessment was that, you know, because New Zealand, they live so far away. One, they're not used to this kind of stuff. You know, they take a threat much more seriously than somebody in Pakistan would. You know, in Pakistan, it's kind of something that they deal with on a daily basis. But you've got to respect that, you know, New Zealand doesn't. And so they were completely within their rights to pull their team out when they felt they were unsafe.
And on the cricket side, Osman, it's heartbreaking for Pakistan fans. You know, I've been 2-3 times now, and it's a fascinating place to tour, and the enthusiasm for the game is just ridiculous. The chief exec, Wazim Khan, I played against him a few times, and what a lovely fellow he is. And I've seen his interview just this morning there, and I feel so sorry for everybody involved in Pakistan cricket. But they had 7 games going into the World T20. They now potentially have none. From a cricketing point of view, how important is it that they regroup quickly? They've got 2 new coaches, a new board that's been set up. It's going to be interesting times for Pakistan on the field as well as what's just happened off the field.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you say 7 games. So they had a 5-game series against West Indies, of which 4 matches were washed out. So they played 1 out of 5. They're going to not play these 5 against New Zealand now, and possibly the 2 against England. So you're looking at 1 out of 12 matches in your run-up. I mean, for once, the PCB had planned it really well. You know, they had 12 games running in, plus your local domestic T20 tournament, not the PSL, but the less glamorous version, the National T20 Cup, which is starting next week. So, you know, there was plenty of time for people to kind of get this match practice in. And, you know, for events out of their control, for reasons out of their hands, they're going to end up playing 1 out of 12. That's not ideal. especially as they're still kind of a T20 team. You know, they're still finding their way through. They've got a couple of issues in the middle order, which they've not been able to resolve. And I think they were hoping that, you know, these matches would give them some more idea. Now, of course, they've had a change of the coaching setup. We've got, you know, they've pulled in Matthew Hayden and Vernon Philander as kind of specialist coaches working underneath Saqlain Mushtaq. And I'm not sure about either of those appointments, mainly because, you know, neither of them have had any kind of real coaching experience. Vernon was still playing. And I know that Western Province weren't entirely happy that they signed up this deal for him to be coaching while he's still supposed to be playing for them in the domestic season. So, you know, he was still playing. Hayden, I'm trying to remember now, but I don't think he's done any actual coaching. He's been a mentor for some Australian sides at the behest of Justin Langer, I think. But and you know, I think that's what he probably brings, like a few words and a little bit of kind of chest out encouragement. But judging by what people have been saying about him, I can't see him adding that much to Pakistan's batting unit, especially their, you know, where they need help. They're very heavy. They're top heavy. They're loaded up with anchors like Babar and Hafiz and Rizwan, of course. What they need is, like, you know, people in that middle who are real kind of power hitters. They don't waste balls. They come in, they can hit sixes and stuff. I just don't see where Hayden is going to kind of help with that issue, other than maybe a few words of kind of motivational encouragement. But I can't see it going beyond that, really. And Vernon, you know, great bowler, great test bowler. 200 plus wickets at a very low average, but, you know, who's he going to be advising with kind of bowl to bowl, like Steve said off air earlier, you know, 78 miles an hour at the top of off stump? It's not going to work very well in T20s, is it?
No, I don't think it is. I can only assume that the Hayden Philander axis is a temporary thing just for the T20 World Cup, and that Ramiz Raja's vision is a longer one. A longer term plan that he has for Pakistan cricket.
I mean, I hope so. You know, he has said, I think that it reveals some of the thinking, though, in the way that he sold both of them. You know, Matthew Hayden, part of this Australia winning side, he's won World Cups and stuff, and Vernon Philander, I think he specifically mentioned in the release that he had a great record against Australia. But, you know, Australia were a great side until like the mid 2000s, and they haven't been a great side for a long time, least of all in T20s. And if you think of all like the wealth of coaching, of coaches that they've produced, if we're sticking with Australia, you know, there's a lot of decent coaches out there, especially for the short format. There, you know, there's good coaches around the world for short format stuff, not least within Pakistan. You know, Abdul Rahman, who works with Zalmi, is very highly rated by a lot of the players, a lot of the batters especially. But Pakistan are never going to give him a shot because I don't think guys like Ramiz and certainly not Imran Khan know enough of the game right now in the country to be able to highlight him and bring him in and speak to players. I mean, you know, Ramiz was he was not entirely endorsing of Babar's captaincy as well in his press conference. You know, he wanted him to show kind of more attitude and more kind of aggression and stuff. And you just wonder, like, you know, the PCB have built Babar's profile very assiduously over the last year. You know, they pushed him to become like this great thing. And he's a very good batsman, but, you know, he's not ended his career yet, and he's not great, but the PCB have been pushing him very hard to become like this kind of figure for Pakistan cricket. And then here comes suddenly the new chairman. He's like, well, you know, I'm not 100% sure about you as coach. And the fallout, of course, the collateral is, the worry is that, you know, it might affect his batting, and that Pakistan can least afford to affect the batting of, like, you know, probably their greatest talent in the last like 20 years. So yeah, it's interesting times. Ramiz has got a lot on his plate immediately now that we're here. And then we can worry about Hayden and Philander in the dressing room.
When is it not interesting times in Pakistan cricket? Osman, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. And we always enjoy your insight and your knowledge. Thank you very much indeed.
Anytime, guys. Thank you so much for having me.
Osman Samiuddin, ESPN Cricket Info correspondent. Right, let's hear from New Zealand cricket chief executive David White, who said that despite what happened, he had no regrets about the team going to Pakistan in the first place.
I'm comfortable with the decision we made. We went through a thorough security checks. We're ensured of the very high level of security that was to be provided. And also, there have been a number of teams that have toured there recently. You know, South Africa a few months ago, the West Indies, Zimbabwe. So we don't regret the decision to tour there. But like I said, on Friday, it all changed when the security levels increased significantly.
That was New Zealand Cricket Chief Executive David White. Now, I'm delighted to say that we're joined on the line now from Islamabad by one of the world's most experienced independent television directors, who was there, was due to be directing the series between Pakistan and New Zealand. It must have been quite extraordinary, Hemant. I mean, a couple of days ago, I would have said unprecedented that a game should be called off within an hour or a couple of hours of the start. But of course, we saw it with the fifth test between England and India. But just talk us through what happened. I mean, you spent the day rigging and getting the whole production ready the day before. You turn up to the ground, you're ready to go. How did you hear the news?
Well, we actually were working until 4 a.m., you know, on the day of the game. We were setting stuff up because there were a few issues around the equipment, as there always are in the first game, and this was a short rig. So we were doing our stuff at about 4 a.m. We left, we came back. I delayed the call time by a little bit because I wanted people to recover. We came to the ground and we started stuff as usual. We prepped everything. And then we just realized that the players were not at the ground. So we thought that perhaps it's, you know, an issue where they started late. It happens sometimes. And we were to go on air 45 minutes before the start of play. At that time, the players were not on. So we were foreseeing a slightly delayed start, but, you know, nothing of, you know, of the ilk of what happened. And we rolled the clock to start. And we were 33 seconds away from going on air when we were told to stop. So we were basically 33 seconds away from broadcast. I've never seen that happen before, and I hope it never happens again. It was quite interesting and, yeah, unprecedented, as you said.
What were you told, Hemant? When, at what stage, I presume you assumed it was a COVID issue. At what point did you learn that it was a security issue?
I think one of the commentators got a message from his agent suggesting that it could be a security issue. We didn't know anything about that. We all presumed, and there were stories during the rounds, that three New Zealand players had tested positive. So that was our thought process. And we were wondering whether it would be a similar situation as happened in India, that perhaps they with the Indian tour of Sri Lanka, where they would cancel a couple of matches or push it back by a day or something and play two matches at a stretch. But eventually, it didn't turn out that way. I mean, we got to know about an hour or so later that there was actually an issue with security, and that this match would definitely not go ahead. We didn't know the fate of the series as well, because again, with security, you presume that there might have been something, and you don't go to the ground for one game, and then things get sorted out, and then you come back unless there is something dramatic that has happened. So that was where we were.
Was there any sense, because you're at the ground the day before, or you say you're setting up rigging, and my experience as a player, you both teams train the day before, 2 days before, on the ground, you know, catching practice, feeling, trying to get used to being in your surroundings. Was there any sense there was something mumbling then, because both teams probably would have been out on the field practicing while you were doing your rigging up?
Oh, it was very relaxed. I mean, the New Zealanders were practicing, the Pakistanis had practiced earlier. So there was absolutely no sense of that. Actually, we were asked not to use the ground while the teams were practicing. So that was one of the things that delayed our rig as well. We had to wait until they had vacated the ground. So they practiced, you know, in the normal fashion for a good long while. And they seemed quite happy, which was why it was an absolute bolt from the blue the next day when this transpired. And apparently, according to the news reports that I see, things changed overnight as per New Zealand. So it was a little bit strange for us that there was absolutely no inkling of anything. And then suddenly they just up stakes and left. And these things happen, obviously. And if there is a threat or a perceived threat, then teams are right to go for, you know, whatever decision they want, depending upon government advice. But what I find, you know, strange is that nothing has been shared, and they're saying they won't even share it with the host board. So if there was a problem, you know, surely you owe it to the host to let them know what the issue was, especially because their players are there as well. And they would, you know, if there is a security issue, they could fall prey to it as well. So I would think that, you know, they should have let, you know, the host board know what the problem was, at least, so that the host board could go and solve it.
just finally, Himant, it was remarkable. We don't know the details, but it was remarkable for David White, the New Zealand Cricket Chief Executive, to say that there were details that he would share neither privately nor publicly with the Pakistan Cricket Board, which is extraordinary. But we don't know the details, so I guess we shouldn't judge. My instinct is one of enormous sympathy with Pakistan Cricket Board. You've spent a lot of time in the country. It must have been deeply disappointing, and that's an understatement.
Absolutely. Very, very deeply disappointing, especially because they've done so much to bring cricket back to the nation. So, I mean, that's, you know, this becomes a huge setback because it allows other countries to sort of pull out as well. It becomes a sort of, you know, fallback for everybody else. And it is going to be tough, especially Ramiz Raja having just taken over. You know, he had lots of plans. Now he has to go back to the basics and get everything rolling again to build the confidence up again. So that's an issue that I see. But yeah, I mean, I think that they've gone through this before. They've survived. And I have all hopes that they will do so again. I feel sorry for the players because they had, you know, 7 T20 games lined up before the World Cup. And now they might have none. And that is a tough thing for a team that was, you know, wanting to settle in their combinations and perhaps, you know, even make one or two changes before the October 10 deadline. And all that goes out of the window all of a sudden. And they don't even know why, because details will not be shared. So it's a little bit harsh on them. I won't judge New Zealand because obviously there must be some mitigating factors. But I just feel that, you know, if everybody knew what had happened, then there would be some sort of closure for everyone.
Himant, thank you for your time, your insight and your wisdom and your expertise when I occasionally work for you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, Manus.
Now, the Ashes is set to begin in just over 2 months, yet the England players still don't know if they'll be going to Australia this winter or not, with several players prepared to pull out if the quarantine rules don't change or at least relax a little bit. Let's get more on this as Australian cricket writer and broadcaster Robert Craddock joins us. Crash, fantastic to have you with us once again. I've got a whole list of questions here, but I'm not going to start on them because we're just going to ask you for a summary of the situation. I want to know, first of all, if you're still as confident as you were 3 or 4 weeks ago that the Ashes won't be postponed or even moved. So give us an update and then Harmy and I will fire away with questions.
Okay, Manus, here's the long and the short of it. I believe the chance of the Ashes being postponed is zero. Scheduling just doesn't allow it, so I'm not even going to talk about it. As far as being abandoned, I don't believe it'll happen. The breakthrough came yesterday with Stuart Broad's column in the Mail on Sunday saying, I'm going to tour, and he actually said, I believe 100% there will be some sort of England team in Australia. Now, that pretty much lines up with what we're hearing, that no, it won't be a full-strength team, that some players will withdraw, but Australia will simply say to England, just keep picking them until you get a team that comes here. It's worth $200 million to Australia. The series has to go ahead. There may be two tests in some states, none in others, but I think it'll happen.
And just a little bit more on that. I mean, it seems that Queensland and Western Australia, Brisbane and Perth, seem to have got the pandemic under control. Or am I under-reading the situation?
No, they have. Queensland had zero cases today and Perth is basically like a fortress. But Manus, something else has happened which is really interesting. New South Wales is just about to open up. It's reaching about 70% vaccination and it's just about to trial a system where you can come in from overseas and only have 7 days quarantine. Now, I've spoken to the New South Wales government and I said, have cricket called you at all? And they said, no, but we're expecting a call. I think that could be a vehicle for a lot of English players to ease their tensions. I mean, a 7-day quarantine. I mean, they're doing 6 for the World Cup in Dubai. So I think that may ease a bit of tensions. But look, it's fascinating to see. I've genuinely got no idea how many frontline players will pull out of the England team. I'm sure Steve would be better informed on that than I am. I know they've spoken to young single players in the squad and said, we've got to be all in this together. So it's interesting.
Yeah, from the players' point of view, though, Crash, it's having an idea of where you're going, what you're doing, or what the restrictions are at this minute in time, nobody seems to know. And what Stuart was saying in his column, and you meant, you know, the point that he wrote yesterday, I thought it was a fantastic column by Stuart Broad, saying we want to go, we want to help, we want to keep cricket playing, but we want to know what the situation is before we make a decision. If the decision is 14 days quarantine, families can't come, then at least the players know what's going on. And I think that is a frustrating part from a lot of players' perspective is, right, I'm happy to go if you tell me what I'm going to do. Yep. And I think that is the stumbling block at this minute in time for a lot of the players, and the frustrating part from ECB and probably Cricket Australia to get the players over there is the need to know what sort of restrictions is going to be when they land in Australia to get them to best prepare to perform for an Ashes series, because cooped up in a hotel for 14 days, not being able to train and not being able to get out and not being able to go and then say, right, you're going to go and play a test match in 2 weeks' time. That can't happen because the players will not be ready to perform for England.
Yeah, I thought it was a terrific point by Stuart. And I totally get that, Steve, because I sense that from England's point of view, it's almost like stepping back in time to where they were 12 months ago with lockdowns and all that. And you've moved past that in England, and we get that, and we get how intimidating it must be to move backwards. So I'll put this on you. I think it probably will be 14 days quarantine, but they will be allowed out to train each day. Now, if that's roughly the quarantine demands on them, Steve, what's your gut feeling? I mean, do you think there'll be further players pull out? Will that be enough? Will some players say, no, I just can't do it?
I think players will pull out. I think what some players will probably be pulling out for is not the quarantine. It's the family situation over Christmas. I think that is a different argument altogether. I think if you've got players coming to Australia, having the 14 days, but being able to train and being able to get ready and perform for England, I don't see there being an issue there. I think a lot of the other stuff, the players pulling out, will be more for family reasons and that, basically. So, you know, England will send a team. I look at the last 12 months you mentioned, and we can talk about what's happened with Pakistan and New Zealand, trying to keep cricket going. But Cricket Australia, for large part, I think I seen a stat the other day, just this morning, you know, teams that have played away test matches so far during this pandemic in 2019. And Australia haven't played a test match away from home. So for Cricket Australia and the Australian government to say, yes, we're going to lose 200 million, we are desperate for England to come. Well, they didn't come to the Rugby World Cup. They haven't gone away and played cricket away from home. Is it an argument for the ECB to say, well, why should we move when you're not moving with the world cricket stage?
Do you know what? Totally fair question. I mean, Australia has no high ground in this argument, Steve. Like, let's put it this way. Australia didn't even go to South Africa. That tour was cancelled. They didn't set foot in the country. Half the team or a quarter of the team didn't go to the West Indies and Bangladesh recently. So if that's the stance you take, you then can't criticise English players for not coming here. And I think that, you know, it's totally fair. It really is. I don't see much wriggle room, Steve, in those quarantine conditions for the family. I think the government will say to cricket, hey, hang on, we're already giving you concessions. We're letting wives and that into the country and family when 10,000 Australians want to come home and can't. I think that's their argument. If it was just up to cricket, they would loosen all these qualifications. But it's there and it's a sticking point. And I'm sort of... You probably think that Australia's thinking, oh, I hope it's a weak team. It's absolutely the opposite. Australians would love to see Ben Stokes here. We know he's not coming. They'd love to see Archer here. We know he's not coming. We hope it's the strongest possible team. We really, really do.
And yeah, on that crash, how can you reassure the England players that the restrictions aren't going to change while they're in the country? What happens if they're moving a test match the following week? And all this comes in. This is, for me, why it has to be sorted out literally as soon as possible. Because England pick their squad next week. If I'm an England player, I'm going to my board. I'm going to Ashley Giles, well, what happens if these borders close? Yep. What happens if we get stuck here? All these questions, they need to be answered very, very quickly. How close are Cricket Australia, the Australia government, to say, right, we're going to play 3 test matches here, 2 test matches there. This is your quarantine law. Right. Who's coming?
It's a good question, because that was what India's frustration was last time they were in Australia last season. The rules actually changed after they got here. And Ravi Shastri, you know how he delivers a great sermon? Like when they got to the last test at the Gabba, he said, "We are being, you know, we're being cornered here and we're being wronged and all this." And he gave this Churchillian address to the players about how Australia was ganging up on him. And guess what? It seeped in. It motivated them beyond belief, and they cracked the 33-year hoodoo at the Gabba. So it's funny. He turned a negative into a positive, but the point is a correct one. Australia can only give so many guarantees to England, because when they come here, COVID being COVID, and as I said, there's seven different Australians, things can change on the run.
Just a quick one from me, Crash, before we let you go. Give us an update on the team and Tim Payne. But mostly, I want your view on Matthew Hayden being appointed as Pakistan's batting coach or batting consultant for the T20 World Cup. I find that fascinating. You're his biographer. You know him better than most. I've always found that he talks a kind of highbrow gibberish, even when he's speaking English. So I don't know whether that language barrier, that double language barrier, is going to work with the Pakistan batsman. And does he have any coaching experience at all? I know that Ramiz Raja said, well, he's Australian and he's won World Cups. So, you know, who needs coaching qualifications if you're blessed with those qualities?
Yeah, well, here's the thing. I actually spoke to Matthew in Dubai. The order came down from Imran Khan, the prime minister, who said, get Hayden. So he said to Ramiz Raja, so completely out of the blue came the call, and Haydos said, oh, look, I'm not much thinking about coaching. And he thought, you know what, I might do it. It's an interesting one, because he had some gladiatorial contests with Pakistan players, including Shoaib Akhtar. There was a time in the desert they were playing in Sharjah, and he actually he said to Shoaib, you'll be off the field in four overs. I'm going to count down those balls. 24, 23, you know what I mean? Sent him. They used to have these great struggles, but there was a great respect there. He said to me, he said, and your point's a good one, Manners, about, he's, you know, it's quite cerebral, Matthew. He said, I'm just going to be really simple with the players and try and just get them to play with freedom in 2020. I'm going to do a lot of watching. I'm going to do a lot of listening. And he's there with Vernon Philander, who, of course, was he the most underrated bowler in the world during his era? He probably was, Neil, wasn't he? And so it's a challenge he never thought he'd have, completely and utterly from left field. And when I picked up the phone to him, you know what his first sentence was? He said, are you going to write the headline? How about this? Hayden after Langer's job. of course, he's not. He doesn't want to do it, but he spends half his life sticking up for Justin Langer, but they will come up against each other in the World Cup. It'll be great.
And on that point, a final point then, is Justin Langer still under pressure? And is Tim Payne going to be fit? And how's the rest of the team looking? I mean, they've hardly played any cricket for a year.
Tim, it's a really good... I mean, Steve Statt was right. Zero overseas tests in 2 years. Tim Payne had two discs replaced in his neck, and he reckons he'll be right for the first test. So it's, I get it that he's going to be, but gee, it's a big, big operation. Justin Langer, yes, is under pressure, but his contract ends in about 8 months, Manners. So the players, after not playing for so long, have just got to be big enough to just get on with the job. I just think, and I'll be interested to hear Steve on this, but the coaches who have gone the journey in international cricket are the coolest cats. Trevor Bayliss, John Wright, John Buchanan, even Duncan Fletcher. But just they don't add to the tension in the dressing room. That's Justin's challenge. He's a good man. He tries hard. But somehow in a test match, I think there's... I remember when Bayliss got the England job, he said there's enough tension in a dressing room without the coach adding to it. And I think Justin had to be mindful of that.
Yeah, and I think it's a great point from a coaching point of view. You make the players feel comfortable as possible, especially in the heat of a test match battle, when mentally cricketers get tired. And we've seen in England against India, and talked about it, the Oval, and it's like the same mental disintegration. It's not, it's just tiredness. What happens, mistakes. And if your coach is constantly, you feel as though your eyes are at the back of your neck and you think he's watching you, or he's putting you under pressure, that's not a great environment to be. But I'm sure Justin's learning how to get better as a coach. And you know, that if that's a point that needs to be addressed, then I'm sure he knows he's been in enough dressing rooms and he's big enough to and man enough to admit that if his coaching style does need to tinker a little bit, I'm sure he'll be fine, because I think he's a fantastic coach. He's a good man. And you've seen the documentaries, which was interesting, I must admit. I'm not sure I would have enjoyed having a camera crew in my dressing room when I was playing, but just one thing about Justin Langer, he's a good man, and if you've got him on your side, I think you're a very, very privileged to have it, because he was a fantastic player and he is a good coach.
You're listening to the Cricket Collective on TalkSport 2 with me, Neil Manthorpe, and Double Ashes winner Steve Harmison. Still to come, we'll pay tribute to Michael Holding after he announced he'll retire from the commentary box. But next, we'll look back at a thrilling T20 finals day. This is the Cricket Collective on TalkSport 2 with the Institute of Cricket.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design, thoughtful construction, and little details that make life in your space easier. And now they're bringing that comfort and style outside with their outdoor collection. Burrow's outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry stain-resistant foam cushions. As always, you get free shipping on every order. Get 15% off at burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
You're listening to the Cricket Collective on TalkSport 2 with me, Neil Manthorpe, and former England fast bowler Steve Harmison. If you've missed any of the show or you wish to catch up, you can download the podcast, now available via the following on feed on the free TalkSport app or wherever you get your podcasts. Okay, time to talk and review T20 Finals Day. And do you know what, Harmy? I want to start with what probably should be my conclusion. And that is that if any English cricket lovers and fans don't realise what a special day it is in the world calendar and what an amazing day for an occasion Finals Day is and how well it's run and what a world-class venue Edgbaston has become. I just want to say, from somebody who's lucky enough to travel all around the world watching cricket in different places and different events and different big occasions, T20 Finals Day is really, really special. Cherish it. It's a marathon, and I have to say, it's arduous, particularly for those who have to work throughout the whole of it. I wasn't there this time, but it was hard work just being part of it on TV. But seriously, honest, what a day, what an occasion.
It is a fantastic occasion. I was fortunate to be in a cricket club watching the final. I was at Shaw Cricket Club speaking at a dinner, and we had it on in the background. It was amazing. I was on, there was a comedian on, but everybody seemed to have one eye on the TV and no interest what I was seeing, full stop. So, and I must admit, I kept a close eye on it as well. It was a fascinating day. The stories from start to finish, you know, Darren Stevens playing against Archie Lennon, you know, first, he won it in 2004, 2 weeks after he was born. It was, you know, Joe Denley and Darren Stevens winning it in 2007, then going winning it again. And I think my overall emotion at the end of it was, we've spent a lot of money on 100. We have had 4 weeks where potentially we've cost us the India Test match series because they've walked out and gone home because they've been twiddling their thumbs for 4 weeks. And we talk about how good the Blast is. And we haven't said much about the Blast this year because the TV companies and other organisations didn't really want to push the Blast because we're desperate to push the 100. Well, I think we've just seen a showcase of a fantastic event with four sides who there weren't the sort of big household names, all from the Southern group. Sussex have worked so hard to get there. They blew their chance and they didn't perform on the day. And you look at the Kent side, you know, not many superstars, but boy, it just shows you a team will beat superstars every day of the week when a team, you know, plays together and performs well. And I thought Bell Drummond was excellent in game one. I thought Stevens, again, 45-year-old. I just thought it was a fantastic day of domestic cricket. And even the mascot race was highly entertaining. And again, I'll back up exactly what you said there. Edgbaston Cricket Ground, Warwickshire's, the home of Warwickshire Karate Cricket Club, is a fantastic venue for sport. It's a great atmosphere, a great viewing point, and under lights, it was magnificent. So well done to everybody at Warwickshire, and well done to Kent.
The first semi-final, Somerset did it at Hampshire, to Hampshire. You know, you just thought, when Hampshire were 80 for five, you just thought, can they do it again? Can they come back again? And they did almost, because, you know, Somerset needed 45 or 50 off the last four overs and got them. Unbelievable. Ben Green, 35 off 18. Josh Davey had just an amazing, I mean, he took 4 for 34 and then scored 11 off three balls with a four and a six to win the game with a couple of balls to spare. So you just wondered then whether Somerset might be destined for success in the final. But as you said, Kent were resilient. They finished top of the group. So, you know, in many ways, they deserve to be successful at the end. Okay, we need to talk about Jordan Cox.
What a day he had. his innings was fantastic. His catch was brilliant.
It wasn't the catch. He didn't catch it.
Well, he didn't catch it. The assist in the catch was fantastic. Actually, the catch he took, deep mid-wicket, was it Bell Drummond went into him? And he was given six. I'm not sure that was right, but it was a fantastic catch to be able to hold on it when somebody got into you. But all I heard early part of the summer was watch out for Jordan Cox. You know, they've got a special talent down at Kent. And on the big stage, this is where you want to see the manners. I've always said, you know, asking players about playing test match cricket, can they handle the atmosphere over 5 days and the arduous effort, the amount of energy you have to use? And can they stand up on the big occasion? Well, the big occasion is finals day. And if they can perform on finals day, you know, you can tick the temperament box as a positive. And I thought Jordan Cox did brilliantly. What did he get? He got 58 off 28 balls. I thought his all-round contribution, especially in the final, on a pressure, big stage. Yeah, well done, Jordan Cox. You were fantastic.
In those catches, those boundary catches, we've seen lots of them now and around the world, you know, and we know and we've spoken about the fact that fielders practice them. But to be able to evaluate that the ball is going to clear the rope and you're going to have to step over the rope if you want to take a conventional catch, to then time the jump, and in most cases, fielders have caught it in the air and then caught the ball and then flicked it back to the supporting fielder. On this occasion, Jordan Cox has not even attempted. He's so far over the rope. He's in fractions of a second. He's kind of figured that he doesn't have time to catch it and flick it back because he'll land. So he's just palmed it back. He's almost punched it. You've got to have strong hands to do that, I would imagine. But also, how do you practice punching the ball, you know, with the palm of your hand to a fielder who's in support? It just staggers me. You keep thinking, well, you won't see better than that. I reckon it must have been about 7 or 8 times now I've seen one of those catches and thought, well, you won't see better than that. And then you do.
It is, and it's amazing. You know, they do practice. You know, we have to say, you know, the preparation is no stone unturned. And I'll special mention Matt Walker, coach of Kent as well, who will get, you know, these catches going and put the pressure onto the fielders to sort of get their house in order to make sure if the ball goes in that area, they can take the catch. So look, it was a fantastic bit of fielding. Element of luck. I think there's always an element of luck with these things and a bit of good fortune. But boy, the way he batted and then obviously with that, everything going in his favour, it was a special day for Jordan Cox. And I must admit, during my time, I didn't even contemplate going over the line and diving and trying to palm things back volleyball style. So, you know, it's just the way the modern world is now, manners.
And just a final word about Sussex and the fact that Phil Salt and Chris Jordan are leaving. It wasn't to be for them. But, you know, they've invested heavily in youth. There was one of my favourite stats of the day was that Archie Lenham, or Darren Stevens, played six seasons of county cricket before Archie Lenham was born. So, you know, Sussex have gone down this route of investing heavily in youth. And we are talking youth. I mean, you know, that half the team's under 20. So hats off to them for doing that, I suppose. I mean, there'll be them people who say, well, we're losing some super players and big names. But, you know, they rather invest in youth than a bunch of 35-year-olds.
Yeah, and that just seems to be the way things are going down at Sussex. I know Luke Wright was on social media and disappointed to see players going. Matt Pryor, a former legend, not just for England, but for, you know, more for Sussex, going through, and he understands the politics of what's happening at Sussex. But I've said many, many times before, man, as the, you know, the clubs, and even I support Newcastle United, the players will come and go. You know, the good times will have struggle times, but the club will always try and do its best and produce the best people that can possibly represent their county. And Sussex are no different. Salt will go, Jordan's gone, but if you're getting players like Archie Lenham and a few others coming through at a young age, and you're giving them the experience and exposure, they'll pay you back. And hopefully for Sussex, the good times will not be too far around the corner, with a group of kids who will turn into young men, who will turn into men, and who will perform well for Sussex. So it wasn't to be on finals day. It's a big occasion, but I tell you what, if they get there again in the not too, you know, distant future, they will draw on this experience, and I'm sure they'll be a lot better than what they were against Kent in the semi-final at Edgbaston.
Yeah, a lot of attention on Archie Lenham, but not enough, I think, on his schoolmate, Dan Ibrahim from Bede School. He's been a regular in all formats and has produced runs and wickets on a regular basis. So look out for him. Right, Harmy, you're listening to the Cricket Collective on TalkSport 2 with me, Neil Manthorpe, and former England fast bowler Steve Harmison. And in the final part of the show, we discuss the IPL and pay tribute to Michael Holding, who announced his retirement from the commentary box this week. You're listening to the Cricket Collective on TalkSport 2 with me, Neil Manthorpe, and Double Ashes winner Steve Harmison. And it's time to talk IPL, which dominates the world cricket landscape in a way and to an extent that many cricket lovers around the world still don't fully appreciate. But that's maybe a topic for another time or later on in a few minutes' time. But first of all, the big news that Virat Kohli is standing down as both India T20 captain and captain of the Royal Challengers Bangalore after this year. And the IPL is set to expand. Not only are two new tenders being put out, or tenders for two new teams being put out for 2022, but the talk of a second season of IPL each year continues to rumble on, perhaps even in America. The IPL, as Harmy and many others of us said 10 years ago, is taking over world cricket, Harmy.
It is, and it is looking to take over a little bit more. And I think we said that last week when India decided that they were going to pack the kit day before the game and decide to go back to the UAE and get things going and miss the Manchester Test match. I think it's a sign of the times. Manners, there's going to be another two teams. I don't have a problem with that. I think it's a fantastic competition. I do worry, though, about a second season every year. And I don't even, and I'm not bothered if it's in America, Timbuktu, or wherever. If there's a second season, that has a huge ramification on international cricket. And that's Test match cricket. Because whatever happens, however long the season is, if it's 8 weeks, that's another 8-10 weeks out of a calendar that we have got too much cricket going on, full stop, from an ICC point of view. But a Test match is so. How they do that, I think that's up to India. And it's, again, a bit like what we said last week. What is our governing body that in charge of the global game, ICC, what are they playing at? Have they still got their fingers up their backsides and just getting their bellies tickled by the BCCI? Or are they going to make a stance and say, you know what? No, you can't have it. It doesn't fit with what the world game. I'd be very, very surprised if that happened, to be honest.
The great Anil Kumble made a speech 4 or 5 years ago now, when it became obvious that the BCCI was dominating. It became, you know, everybody had known for years before that, but when it became apparent that the BCCI was totally and utterly, irrefutably the controlling body in world sport, Anil Kumble made a speech in which he said, with power comes responsibility. And I do hope, and we all have to hope, that you know, that that remains the case. Just very quickly on Virat Kohli, the great man might just be in a bit of a slump, or perhaps he sees that the long road towards the actual end is has started, and that's why he's stepping down or lightening his load of T20 duties.
Yeah, and it's he's a fantastic player for me. He's the best of the modern generation. There is a shelf life to be captain. I've said this for a long time. You can't. It's a freak of nature if you do it for 15 years. It is. It's a freak of nature. You either play for a team that's not very good and you have to do it for 15 years because you're the only one that can do it, or you get 4 or 5 years. You put your stamp on it, and everything evolves, and you know, you just take a little backward step. You still be very vocal. You'll still be very powerful in a dressing room. Still be one of the best players. He will still play. But, you know, sometimes you just get a sense as a player that not only do we need to go in a little bit of a different direction, people are sick of my voice. And that's it. You know, people are sick of my voice. And I think that could be as simple as it is for Virat. You might just be thinking, you know what? We've got a fantastic side. We might just need a different voice. We're singing the same song. You know, the same choir singing the song. You know, we just might need a different lead vocalist to say the same messages, to keep driving us forward, to keep telling us we're better. We might just need a different tune to that song. So, you know, he's done a brilliant job as a TE, and it wouldn't surprise me if RCB go and win the IPL, and it wouldn't surprise me if India go and win the T20 World Cup, because they've got the side. And, you know, when the side goes for their leader, because he's going to come to the end, it wouldn't surprise me if they just go that extra yard for Virat Kohli, and why wouldn't they? Because he's been a fantastic servant as a captain of world cricket, as well as, you know, the India captain, because he has been a captain of world cricket, especially in test matches, which he's carrying on. But I think from a T20 point of view, you know, he's just thinking his team needs a different voice.
Michael Holding. Now then, he's only 67 years old. Many commentators, particularly the great ones like him, tend to carry on and until they can't. You know, they've carried on well into their 80s. So he's called it a day at 67. This is what he said about his thoughts on TV commentary as long ago as 2014.
I don't find cricket commentary difficult. You know, especially, it might be difficult on radio, because I think on radio you have to be a lot more detailed because people can't see it. But on television, the pictures are there already. All you're supposed to be doing is adding to those pictures. So I don't really find it difficult. But when you talk about going off on side issues, I just said sometimes things are a little bit slow. And that is, again, great fun to talk about things of the past or talk about certain issues within the game. Because people are seeing the pictures, they are already, you know, nothing exciting happening. So you give them a story about something else. And I enjoy that aspect of it as well. And depending on who you're on with at the time, it even makes it more fun.
Well, he did make it fun, you know. I mean, he was whispering death. He was very dry behind the microphone. The sense of humour was contagious. What will you miss about him?
Yeah, for me, it was when I heard that, it's a sad day for world cricket, because to not hear Mikey's voice on anything, on whether it's, he wasn't a big T20 fan, he was a traditionalist himself, didn't have social media, he was a simple man with simple values, but what a voice, what a great voice. And I'll miss just the tone of his voice, his input at the right time. And when he was asked what makes a good commentator, he more or less said, not to speak, don't say too much, come in when it's needed to come in, don't say things for the sake of saying things. And a little story about Mikey. I was struggling in 2000, and well, I can't remember what year it was, but it was at Old Trafford. Me and Duncan Fletcher fell out over this, which, not the first time that me and Duncan fell out, and it wasn't the last, to be fair. But I spoke to Mikey on the morning, and I was really struggling at Old Trafford, and I was having a bad time. And I just asked if I could see him. And that was it. I just, any chance I could see him. And I had half an hour with him in between commentary stints. Nobody knew anything about it, apart from Duncan found out. And out the way, and I asked him because he had the best seat in the house. The commentators have got the best seat in the house, a former fast bowler. And I just said, I asked him what if he could see anything that I was doing wrong. And he did. He said I was, I could be possibly trying a bit too hard, trying to bowl a bit too fast, wanting the natural action to come to the fore. And he just said you were pulling out of it. Left side was pulling out far too early. So he was more or less telling me to hang in the air, just a little bit more hang time. And it was the way, I'm not even going to try and do his voice, a little bit more hang time. And it was a typical West Indian way, and it helped a great deal. But Duncan Fletcher didn't see it that way because he didn't like the media. And he said, you've got a perfectly good bowling coach here. I was like, yeah, but Mikey Holden is Mikey Holden. And he is one of the best fast bowlers that's ever been. And he would be he would coach if he didn't commentate, if he wasn't such a brilliant commentator. So yeah, he did help me more than you know, he ever thought he could help me. And I hope he enjoys his retirement, because them horses are going to get some treatment down in Newmarket, because he will never be aware. You know, he's always, you know him well as well, Manners. And I'll ask you, what's your overriding memories of Mikey in the commentary box? Because you spent a lot of time commentating, possibly not for the same channel, but when you commentate, all the commentators are together. They're just along the corridor from each other, and you see a lot of each other in downtime.
My abiding memory is a very simple one, and that is I was terrified of him because he's whispering death. And rather like Curtly Ambrose when he retired, you know, for Curtly Ambrose, I was mesmerizingly terrified of as a player. You know, he would hardly ever do an interview or a press conference. When he did, he would say very little. I just found him terrifying. And when I first met Michael Holding, I assumed that whispering death would be this assassin of a man. And I was, yeah, it took me a while, several days before I realized that he was kind, gentle, caring, empathetic. You know, it's that old difference between either side of the boundary, right? I think he embodies the greatest difference.
He did. And the thing is, as well, and there's been a lot made of the Black Lives Matter stuff and everything that goes with that. But there's some people and people get asked and people get talked about saying things for effect, saying things to promote their own cause. Well, Mikey Holden spoke on Sky News that morning in a tear in his eye. There was no effect on that. There was no self-promotion on that. That was from the heart. That was from somebody who had suffered more than any of us I could even dream about. And that's why Mikey Holden's a great man, because he spoke from the heart. He gave his cause, and it was all about making other people's lives better. And that, for me, that is everything about Michael Holden. He's a brilliant, brilliant man.
Great man, Harmy. We'll see you again, same time, same place next week. You've been listening to The Cricket Collective on TalkSport 2 with me, Neil Manthorpe, and former England fast bowler, Steve Harmison. If you've missed any of the show or you wish to catch up, you can download the podcast, now available on the following on feed or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening to The Cricket Collective on TalkSport 2.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.